Welcome once again to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, California, and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, poets, literary agents, and editors discussing the art and business of writing, and occasionally I get that right. My guests today are Ayelet Waldman, author of The Big Nap, and Michael Chabon, author of The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. Ayelet Waldman is a Harvard Law School graduate and lawyer at the Federal Public Defender's Office in L.A., or she was a lawyer at the Federal Public Defender's Office in L.A., and she's author of Nursery Crimes and The Big Nap. Michael Chabon is author of three novels and two collections of short stories. His second novel, Wonder Boys, was made into a feature film, and his third novel, fifth book, published last year, The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, won the Pulitzer Prize. Michael Chabon and Ayelet Waldman live in Berkeley with their three children. Hello there.
Hello, Barbara. Thanks for having us.
Great to have you. Hi. Now, what's it like, two writers living together, working together, children, deadlines?
That's kind of a big question. It works on days like today. It works fabulously well, doesn't it? We had a very good day today.
Definitely. We've had a very productive couple of days.
Yeah.
As a team.
We edit each other's work, and we Michael did a phenomenal job on a screenplay for Cavalier and Clay, and it was fun working with him on that. And today we got the script for the TV series of the Juliet books that is in consideration at CBS, and that was awfully fun. So we've had a damn fine day.
Now, how do you pull each other into your projects in terms of say ideas? Do you start with the idea stage and get each other's feedback, or do you wait till you've developed what you plan and then run it by your husband or your wife to
Right off from the very first. I mean, often one or the other of us is present when the other one is, you know, sort of birthing the idea, and it's just starting to emerge, and we'll sort of be there to help dredge it up. You know, grab hold of the rope and give a pull.
Or alternatively say, that's the lamest thing I've ever
heard. Exactly. Please don't waste your time doing that. Exactly.
Uh-huh. Well, and is it, does that go along with, say, the plotting of your books, or do you plot? Do either of you plot?
Well, I plot pretty intensively because mine are murder mysteries, and if you don't plot, you end up, you know, 250 pages in and no idea who's the murderer.
Mm-hmm.
But, So I definitely plot early on, and Michael is great on plot details. He's really a fun person to work things out with, and I think anybody is good to have as a sounding board, but it's especially good to have as a sounding board someone with so much experience.
Mm-hmm.
Michael is looser about plot. Why don't you tell her what you...
I start out without a whole lot of ideas about plot, and I try to let the characters and the tone, especially the voice of the story, emerge first, and then once I feel like I've got a pretty good grasp of that, then I will sit down and try to plot very carefully and figure out what I'm doing. And at that stage, I often do turn to Ayelet and try to help me figure out, you know, what I'm doing or the right order to do things. I mean, I think we're pretty much full service shop for each other from start, you know, from the first moments the idea is coming to us till the reading the very final draft.
Interesting.
And at every step of the way.
We have what we call plot walks, where if someone has a tricky problem to work out, we go for a walk and we just kind of talk it through. And that's very helpful usually.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not, I mean, there are many times when there's an argument. It's not like it always goes smoothly.
Oh, there's always an argument. When is there not an argument? There was just an argument the other night, right?
No.
Well, the first thing you said was, no, I don't care. And
that's right.
I said, you have to care.
Right, that's right. I said, you're right, but I don't care.
Right, exactly.
So is it the same if you're working on a short story, Michael? Do you still, is it the same sort of in terms of plotting and...
No, short stories are very different for me. They tend to emerge by very mysterious means, and I just sort of try to step back and allow them to come out, and I'm often you know, not really sure what I'm doing until I finish. And even then, I may not be sure what I've just done. And in that case, it tends to be a little more of a secretive process for me, and I might not really even tell Ayelet I was working on a story until I actually had it done, and I could sort of drop it in front of her and say, what do you think of this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I always think he's out there, you know, plugging away on his novel, and then he comes in, then one morning I'll walk down. We have opposite schedule. Michael writes at night, and I write very early in the morning. And so I'll come down when it's time to get the kids up, and I'll see a perfect short story waiting for me on the kitchen table, and I won't have even known that he's been doing that for a week or two.
Or a night or two,
so they come out that quickly.
Interesting. If you just tuned in, you are listening to Writers on Writing, and my guests are Ayelet Waldman, author of The Big Nap, and Michael Chabon, author of The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. You also have, with your books, you with the mysteries, Ayelet and Michael, the longer novels or the short stories, different sort of lengths of work. And it would seem that, Ayelet, the mysteries are more structured in a way in that, you know, they tend to be of a similar length.
Yeah, you know, the idea with a mystery is that you can read it in a single night. You're so caught up in the plot that if you don't turn off the light, you'll be done in time to make it to work the next morning.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you'd stayed awake to read Cavalier and Clay, you would, you know, suffer some horrible disease.
A few people have berated me for keeping them up, you know, until 3 or 4
night after
the morning.
Night after night.
Well, even with Cavalier and Clay, it seems that literary novels are becoming shorter and shorter, and I don't know if it's because of paper costs or the short attention span of agents and editors or readers or what it is, but did you give that any thought when you were writing that book, Michael?
Oh, not at all. I'm not even sure I quite agree with that. I mean, I think there have been a recent slew of fairly prominent big fat books by very good writers, you know, Mason and Dixon, Underworld, The Corrections, a lot of Jane Smiley's recent books, Moo and Horse Heaven, and I'm drawing a blank now, but it seems like there have been a number of kind of big fat novels that have been fairly, you know, well read, widely read.
Mm-hmm.
Wally Lamb turned in a pretty big
sure.
one last time, and I think the big fat novel is actually in pretty good shape.
Well, that's good to hear.
I mean, don't you enjoy them as a reader? I know I do. I always feel like if a slim book is... I read shorter mysteries because again, you want to read them in a single night. But when I'm looking for a literary novel, I'm looking for something that's going to last me for a little while.
Yeah, you can really sink into.
Definitely. Well, yeah, I don't know. I heard that somewhere, and then I started looking around, and perhaps I was focusing on books like Lying Awake and a few shorter books, and I went, I wonder.
I think what might be happening is that there's a stealth renaissance going on of the novella,
yeah.
Which I think publishers are afraid of, because novella sounds like something where maybe you're not quite getting your money's worth. So they would be afraid to call it a novella, but in fact, a lot of writers do seem to be mining the sort of under 160-page form lately, and those things are being sold as novels, but it might be more accurate to describe them as novellas.
True.
Like Off Keck Road, Mona Simpson's, and
yeah.
Jonathan Latham wrote that McSweeney's published.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and a number of recent Ethan Kanan things, and I think it may be that the novella is just somehow getting marketed as a novel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these terms are all very loose anyway. It's hard to define them.
Interesting. Well, I would love to hear both of you read.
Oh, that
someone.
Was fun. Wait, you have to let me start, honey, because, you know, you won the Pulitzer Prize.
Okay.
It's otherwise, I don't want to follow you. It's too depressing for words. I'm just going to start with the beginning of the mystery. I always threaten that I'll start with the last page, because it doesn't seem fair.
And so if you just tuned in, you are listening to Writers and Writing, and Ayelet Waldman is going to read from The Big Nap.
Chapter 1. I probably wasn't the first woman who had ever opened the door to the FedEx man wearing nothing from the waist up except for a bra. Odds are I was not even the first to do it in a nursing bra, but I'm willing to bet that no woman in a nursing bra had ever before greeted our apple-cheeked FedEx guy with her flaps unsnapped and gaping wide open. You could see that in his face. I thought about being embarrassed, but decided that since I'd been too tired to notice that I wasn't dressed, I was definitely too tired to care. You have to air dry them, I explained, or they can crack. That has to hurt, he said. I signed for the package, which turned out to be yet another sterling silver rattle from Tiffany. That made 7. Closed the door and dragged myself up the stairs to the second floor duplex apartment where I lived with my husband, Peter, my 3-year-old daughter, Ruby, and the mutant vampire to whom I'd given birth 4 months before. Yes, 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 I know, I sang in a mock cheerful voice as I scooped my screaming baby out of his bassinet. Finished your 6-minute nap, have you? That's all the sleep you'll be needing this week, isn't it? Isaac eyed my conveniently exposed nipple and increased the pitch of his wail. I settled my bulk into the aggressively ugly glider rocker that had taken pride of place in our living room and lifted him to my breast. He began suckling as though he'd just gotten home from vacation in Biafra. It had been all of half an hour since he'd eaten. I leaned back in the chair, ran my tongue over my unbrushed teeth, and looked up at the clock on the mantelpiece. Noon, and I'd been awake for 8 hours. Actually, it's hardly fair to say that I woke up at 4 a.m. That was just when I'd finally abandoned the pretense that night was a time when we, like the rest of the world, slept. Isaac Applebaum Wyeth never slept. Never. Like, really never. It was my firm belief that in the 4 months since his birth, the kid hadn't closed his eyes for longer than 20 minutes at a stretch. Okay, that's not fair. There was that one time when he slept for 3 hours straight, but since I was at the doctor's office having a wound check, bullet and cesarean, but that's another story altogether, at the time of this miracle, I had only Isaac's father's word that it had actually occurred, and I had my doubts. Sitting there, nursing Isaac, I entertained myself by imagining what I would be doing if I were still a federal public defender and not a bedraggled stay-at-home mom. First of all, by this hour of the day, I'd have already finished 3 or 4 bail hearings. I might be on the way to the Metropolitan Detention Center hoping my smack addict clients were straight enough to have a conversation about their plea agreements. Or I might be in trial, striding around the courtroom, tearing into a quivering FBI agent and exposing his testimony for the web of lies that it was. All right, maybe not. Maybe I'd be watching my client self-destruct on the stand while he explained that the reason he was covered in red paint and holding the sack of the bank's money, complete with the exploding dye pack, was because his friend borrowed his clothes and car and did the robbery and then mysteriously gave him his the bag and, no, he doesn't remember his friend's name. That's actually the text of the testimony that my very first client presented to the jury on the stand in the federal court in Orange County.
Oh, here?
Yeah. It wasn't him. It was a friend, and he was covered in dye because he took the bag, and he gave the guy his clothes, and he gave the guy his car, and how did his fingerprints get on the note? Oh, he was fondling the note. He was touching the note. Yeah. The jury felt so sorry for me, and they felt especially sympathetic because my darling husband was sitting in the front row of the jury, of the courtroom, cheering me on as I went down in a ball of fire. It was a brutal, brutal trial. And shocking, you know what the most shocking thing about it was?
What?
The greatest travesty of justice of it all. He was convicted.
Can you believe that?
Shocking.
I can't
shocking.
Believe it. You have just heard Ayelet Waldman read from The Big Nap. I want to talk to you about voice, but maybe we should have Michael read.
Okay.
I'll talk to you both about
now
voice.
Now you're in for something fabulous.
Okay. I'm just going to read from about 150 pages into the book, but hopefully it won't be too confusing. His ears still ringing with artillery shells, screaming rockets, and the clattering ack-ack of Gene Krupa from the Crosley in the corner of the studio, Joe Cavalier laid down his brush and closed his eyes. He had been drawing, painting, smoking cigarettes, and nothing else for much of the past 7 days. He clapped a hand to the back of his neck and engaged the bones that supported his battle-blown head in a few slow rotations. The vertebrae clicked and creaked. The joints of his hands throbbed, and the ghost of a brush notched his index finger. Each time he took a breath, he could feel a hard little billiard of nicotine and phlegm rattling around in his lungs. It was 6 o'clock on a Monday morning in October 1940. He had just won the Second World War, and he was feeling pretty good about it. He slid off of his stool and went to look down on the autumn morning through the windows of the Kremler building. Steam purled from the orifices of the street. A crew of a half dozen workers in tan canvas coveralls with peaked white caps perched atop their heads used a water hose and long disheveled brooms to sluice a grimy tide down the gutters toward the storm drains at the corner of Broadway. Joe threw open the rattling sash of the window and poked his head out. It looked like it was going to be a fine day. The sky in the east was a bright Superman blue. There was a dank, Octoberish smell of rain in the air, with a faint, acrid tang from a vinegar works along the East River 7 blocks away. To Joe, at that moment, it was the smell of victory. New York never looks more beautiful than to a young man who has just pulled off something he knows is going to knock them dead.
Thank you.
Great, honey.
Yeah, very nice. That was Michael Chabon reading from The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, which won the Pulitzer Prize last year. Who got the call? What happened?
I got the call.
Yeah, I got the call.
Here's the thing. I knew he was going to win. I knew he should win. I've been saying he was going to win all along because I went to the Pulitzer website and I read about it, and it just was, of course he would win. It was the best book for that prize that year. But then nobody called all morning. So Michael went out to his office to, I don't know, do his email, be glum. And I stormed off to my office to sit and feel all sorts of rage at the powers that be in the prize world. And then all of a sudden the phone rang. And I guess the backstory of this all is that at this point I was about 8 months pregnant, right, Michael?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With our third child. So the phone rang, and I had just gotten off the phone with Michael's old editor, who told me that he had once heard from someone that they heard about their Pulitzer Prize from a reporter that they didn't actually hear from the prize committee. So the phone rings, and I pick it up, and I hear this voice say, "Hi, this is, what's his name, Hillel Atavi mm-hmm. from the AP." And I just started screaming. I was screaming at the top of my lungs. I was shrieking and shrieking and shrieking and shrieking. And then
I was out in my office, and I heard this horrible, blood-curdling screaming coming from somewhere, and I didn't know where. And I ran out of my office, and I just listened to see who was being assaulted, and it seemed to be coming from inside my house. And then I was even more worried because she was 8 months pregnant, and I thought something horrible was happening. And I ran into the house, and she ran towards me, and she jumped into the air. She leapt into my arms, all however.
170 pounds
of her, and she was screaming, "Yeah, you won the Pulitzer Prize! You won the Pulitzer Prize!" It was very exciting.
I danced around shrieking for about a minute, and then I realized that I was still holding the phone with the reporter on the other line. So Michael gets on, and he's like, "Oh, so I guess you didn't know."
Yeah.
Oh, that's great.
It was a great day.
Moment. That was just such a great day.
It really was.
Maybe the best day of my life next to our wedding.
Yeah, what a great story. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and my guests are Ayelet Waldman, author of The Big Nap, and Michael Chabon, author of The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. Oh, boy. What could we talk about now? Nothing. Voice, actually, because in reading your books, but also in listening to you read, you, Ayelet, very much sound like your character in your book, and
they do say write what you know.
Yeah, it's interesting, but it's interesting. Have you both? You know, you both have very distinct voices, and I'm curious how you both came to them. If it was a breeze, or what the process was to arrive there.
Well, I mean, for me, the voice, at least in some modulation of the voice, is different in everything that I write, and it's part of the initial challenge for me, and really I think probably the single most important moment in the composition of anything that I'm working on to try to find the right tone of voice for whether it's a short story or a novel or whatever it is I happen to be writing. You know, part of that is a question of point of view and whether I'm writing in the first person or the third person. It's a question of who I decide the narrator is. And I think that is, for me, ultimately, the single most important question that you have to ask yourself when you're beginning something is, who is telling this story? Is it the character, him or herself? If so, what kind of person is that Or is it some kind of narrator, a third-person narrator? And if so, what kind of narrator? And what's the role, what's the relationship between the narrator and the story that's being told? And I spend a lot of time, I can spend a lot of time trying to settle that question before I really will get going on something. So, for example, with The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, it took me a while to realize what kind of narrator I had in this story, and that narrator is essentially an omniscient narrator, one who knows everything about the characters, all of their thoughts, all of their feelings, all of their histories, all of their secrets. Not only that, but the narrator also knows their futures, and he knows everything that's going to happen to all of these characters, even things that don't get treated in the novel, in the text of the novel itself. And yet this narrator is also kind of a historian narrator who has available to him the thoughts and actions and history of comic books, of prominent people of the time. There's a kind of what I tried to do was to create a sense that this was not really a work of fiction at all, but more of a narrative history about people who actually lived, these two cousins who created this character. And I wanted there to be a certain amount of doubt or confusion in the reader's mind about just how much of this was really true and how much of it was made up. And it took me a little while to get that narrator, but once I did, it was a very true companion for me, and it really got me through the long process of writing this book. So to me, it's a crucial thing. I mean, I think there's a certain similarity of voice in everything I write. You can tell it's me, but to me, there's a significant difference among them too, and it really depends on the story and the narrator.
What is the process like in finding that narrator? I mean, do you do writing around the characters or any sort of pre-writing, trying to figure it out, or is it a lot of sitting and looking out the window? Or
I go by feel, and I just sometimes I will just start, and it comes out instantly perfect. I recently wrote a short story that is about it's a first-person narrative of a father talking about a little episode in the life of him and his son, and that first-person narrator just came out in the first moments of my writing. The first sentence of the story, I recognized right away that this was the right tone, and I just stuck with it, and I was able to write this story in about 2 days. Sometimes I will start, I try to establish the tone in the very first sentence if I can, so that I would just go over and over and over my first sentence, tossing out first sentences and trying new ones until I hit one that just somehow feels right, that feels capable of doing what I think it is I want to do. But, you know, it can be, in the course of a novel, what you think is your first sentence and what you think is the tone you've established can change. And so with The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, what is now the first sentence was something that I wrote almost the last thing that I wrote, mm-hmm. was really the first sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And the original first sentence is now buried a little bit, about 2 pages in, or maybe a page and a half in. So these kind of things can change. It happened with The Mysteries of Pittsburgh, my first novel, too, whereas with Wonder Boys, the first sentence just popped out almost exactly as it's written, and I never even went back and rewrote it once. It just was right from the start.
So funny, Michael, because I just looked at your first sentence of Cavalier and Clay again, and I had totally forgotten. I mean, I remembered it as being that sentence that it was for years and years and years. I forgot that you put that. It's a better first sentence. That's there.
Oh, thank you.
and is that, did that happen after the whole book was written?
Yeah, and what I realized was I had this narrator capable of ranging in space and time, and I wanted to establish that fact from the very beginning, where the original first sentence was limited to a single point of view, and it didn't have that sort of all-powerful quality that I wanted to just tell the reader, look, you're in the hands of someone who knows everything when you're reading this book.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tried to come up with a first sentence that would establish that from the very beginning. So it starts out by saying, many years later.
Right.
And in a way, and so the first thing I say about any of the characters is about at a moment at which you will never see any of them again, sometime roughly in the present day. We are presented with Sam Clay kind of in his old age, And then that's it. We never see him like that ever again.
Read it.
In later years, holding forth to an interviewer or to an audience of aging fans at a comic book convention, Sam Clay liked to declare, apropos of his and Joe Cavalier's greatest creation, that back when he was a boy, sealed and hogtied inside the airtight vessel known as Brooklyn, New York, he had been haunted by dreams of Harry Houdini. And, you know, I confess I was somewhat influenced in writing that first sentence by the first sentence of 100 Years of Solitude, which does something similar, I think does it better than mine, in sort of coursing through time, starting out and saying when he faced, many years later, when he faced the firing squad, Colonel Aureliano Buendia was to remember that time many years before when his father took him to see ICE.
That's so true.
Sort of goes far into the future and then comes all the way back into the past, all in one sentence. And I was kind of trying to do something very similar.
Interesting. Well, I yell it.
Yes.
Voice.
Well, I started writing because I didn't want to go back to work. Is really what it comes down to. I was a public defender, a federal defender in L.A., and I had tried to go back to work when my daughter was a little baby, and it just wasn't working out for me, mostly because I was so jealous of Michael home with her. So I was teaching law, and I was trying to write a law review article on some astonishingly tedious piece of arcane legal nothingness. And I would go to the library every day, and I would fall asleep. And one day, I just kind of started spewing out this character. And I had a lot to say about what it felt like to be a mother and what it felt like not to know what your professional identity, what you had left of a professional identity when after you've had children. And it is very, very close to me. I mean, Juliet sounds like me. She makes the same kind of jokes. She used to have a husband who was very like mine, but he was just way too good to be true. So in later books, he's become a little less Sabon-like and a little more rest of humanity-like. But in a way, you know, writing these Juliet books is really how I learned to write. I used to say that I never had, this is the first piece of fiction I ever wrote. But the truth is that I was, like I said, a federal public defender, and one of the things you have to do is write sentencing memoranda where you explain to the judge why your client is such a good person and shouldn't go to jail. So I've been doing a lot of creative writing for many years, but this is the first piece of official fiction. So I learned on the job. You know, I learned by writing nursery crimes, and I think they've gotten better and better, and I'm in the middle of the fourth one now, and I think it's you know, it's a whole other thing. But I've also written a novel that isn't in a voice very similar to mine at all. It's the murder victim is the head of a preschool that rejects Juliet's daughter. And we had gone through the application process for preschools in Los Angeles. So maybe there's some characters that might be similar to some people in real life, and maybe terrible things might happen to them. But, you know, I think for me it's always, I pick little bits of all sorts of different people of myself, of my family, people that I meet in the street, people that I've known. It's sort of how I try to make sure that my characters are real by basing them in ways, in different ways, on different real people. And in terms of, you know, nobody, as of yet, neither Michael nor I has discovered a dead body, but other parts of the Juliet books are pretty true to our lives together.
I frequently will draw on a lot of different things, just sort of as I need them, bits and pieces of stuff that I've experienced, people that I've known. I think for me, as I've gotten... As actual details of my life have become more known to more people, I kind of explore that relationship between my life and my fiction, or I'm trying to play with that just a little bit. And the last story that I wrote is about a father and a son. And, you know, I have a son. Plenty of people know that my son is pretty much the same age as the character that I'm writing about. And I very deliberately I think, kind of played with the fact that readers wouldn't be sure whether they were reading something that was really about me or something that I was making up by trying to write this short story in a very matter-of-fact, seemingly factual tone, as though I were reporting an actual incident from my life, and yet really the incident and event of the story were almost entirely invented.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I'm sort of trying to flirt a little bit with the strange fact that lots of strangers out there know things about my life that I have never told them personally.
Mm.
You know, everybody assumes it's all your life anyway.
Right.
So, and that makes for, that makes it extra fun to make stuff up because.
Exactly. I think you need to try to have fun with that. The fact that you know readers are just automatically assuming you're talking about yourself or people you know.
Tell her what you always say to your dad when he asks you what your story is about.
Well, I wrote a series of, for a while, let's just say fathers were appearing in my fiction fairly often. And it made my dad very nervous because people always assume that if there was a father in one of my stories, that father must be based on my father. And these fathers were not always doing the most socially acceptable or attractive things. And so my dad started to get kind of leery of a new piece of mine coming out because of all the conclusions to which people were going to be leaping about him from reading these, you know, fictional stories. And so when we used to tell him I had just finished something, he would always very trepidatiously say, "What's it about?" And I would always say, "Oh, it's about a cross-dressing pediatrician. My dad is a doctor," or something like that. And he would laugh very nervously as though he knew I was joking, but he wasn't totally sure, and he was a little worried.
That's perfect. Gee, we have a few minutes left and so many more questions, but one thing I wanted to ask you, Michael, was that you went through the MFA program here at UCI.
Indeed, I'm an anteater.
Yes, you're an anteater. and the Mysteries of Pittsburgh, as I recall from, I think when there was an article in the LA Times, that you had submitted it, I think, to an agent or editor before your advisors thought it was ready, and you got a book deal.
No,
the opposite.
What happened was I gave it to one of my advisors just to read it, and that was McDonald Harris, Don Heine, who was one of the two main instructors in the MFA program, and he read it and sent it to his agent without telling me. And then she took it on and sold it. So, I mean, it was accepted for publication before it was approved as my thesis, but
yes.
That was just, that had nothing to do with me.
Interesting. So, you know, I teach through the extension here, and my students are always asking me about MFA programs here and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And different writers that come on, especially that have been through MFA programs, I always am curious whether they advise that chunk of money to go into an MFA program or a cabin somewhere to write.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about
you could use that chunk of money and buy us a cabin.
That's another thing.
We're
another
picking
option.
Up a collection. I mean, I always say the same thing, which is that all other things being equal, the program that offers financial aid, financial support, that offers either a free ride, as some very few of them do, or a teaching assistantship kind of thing, but will offer you enough financial support that you will not have to maintain a full-time job,
mm-hmm.
that you will be able to quit your full-time job in order to, and for those 2 years you will be working considerably less than you are now in your normal everyday real life, quote-unquote,
mm-hmm.
That is the program to go to. And if the program is going to be, particularly if the program is going to be charging you an arm and a leg and you're still going to have to keep your day job, then I would steer clear of it. It's just not, you're going to end up writing even less than you do now because writing programs do put a certain amount of, certain demand on your time. And you want all of your other responsibilities to be reduced as much as they possibly can be. And they really, the only way to do that is by finding a program that will help support you.
So program or no program, that you can write and go to school and work very little.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Exactly.
Time. It's all about time.
Yeah. I mean, I wrote The Mysteries of Pittsburgh at UC Irvine because I was teaching 20 hours a week, and that was it,
mm-hmm.
and going to classes, but the class load wasn't onerous by any means.
Mm-hmm.
And I had tons of time for writing.
Yes.
Time that, just so much like we have now, honey.
Oh, yes.
So much time with all the children and the dog and scads, piles of time. That's why I write from 5 o'clock in the morning till about 7:30, and Michael writes from 10 o'clock at night till about 3 or 4 in the morning.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. What about novels and novels affecting lives? How do you want your readers to feel when they've put down your books, both of you?
I want my readers to feel
like they want to run right out and buy the next one.
Yeah. I want people to feel, you know, entertained. The Juliet books in particular, talking right now about The Big Nap and the Juliet books, I want them to feel like they had a good time, that they spent time with someone that they like to be with and that they like to be with again. The novel that I wrote that's now being shopped to publishers is a serious novel, and it's set against the backdrop of the drug war. And I wanted people, when they finished that book, to feel like people they cared about had been victimized by a tragic and terrible thing, the war on drugs. So I didn't want them to feel good. I wanted them to feel outraged
mm-hmm.
and sad. And you know, but people always like to feel when they finish a good book. So it's different for every book, I think.
I would like readers to feel that they're sorry that the book is over.
Mm-hmm.
Just that they're sorry it came to an end, and they wished it would have just kept going.
Interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing. We have just a few minutes left with Ayelet Waldman, author of The Big Nap, and Michael Chabon, author of The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, and a couple of other things. Any advice regarding agents?
Glory.
Literary agents seem to inspire.
We have friends who did great by just submitting, you know, blind submissions.
Two agents, yeah.
And they each got an agent, and they each have a book deal now.
Mm-hmm.
Two close friends of ours this happened to over the past couple of weeks. What is Squaw Valley? That's the advice I give people, Michael.
Mm-hmm.
Squaw Valley Community of Writers is a writers' conference up in, curiously enough, Squaw Valley. And it was started by Oakley Hall, who was
from here,
the director of the
Irvine Program. And it's now run by Louis B. Jones, and he is an Irvine graduate. It's run by Louis and Brett Hall, his
mm-hmm.
wife. And that's an amazing conference because people come from all over. They're agents there, they're editors there, and they come looking for talent.
Yeah, they're
not there just to, like, you know, hang out in the summer in Squaw Valley. They're there because they're looking. You know, Amy Tan got discovered there. Janet Finch got discovered there.
Anne Rice, even.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Whitney Otto.
Yeah, all these people got discovered at Squaw, and it's a wonderful place. So what you do is, you know, you submit a writing sample, and you go and you spend a lovely week in workshops. Michael and I go almost every year. And sometimes, almost every year, there's someone who walks away with an agent or a book deal.
Mm-hmm.
And even if that doesn't happen, you get a lot of good advice on how to make your book better.
Yes.
And it's fun.
It is fun. I was there in the early 90s. And,
oh, yeah.
And just got their bulletin today, actually, that had a half a page about Michael.
Oh, did it?
Yeah.
There's also another Irvine graduate, Glenn David Gold, who wrote this wonderful book called Carter Beats the Devil. And another Irvine graduate, Alice Sebald, she wrote a memoir called Lucky, and she has a new novel coming out.
Yeah, because of the Oakley Hall connection, there have always been close ties between East Irvine and Squaw Valley.
Mm-hmm. I know you both have a thing to go to at 6. I want to let you go, but perhaps if both of you could offer some last words for writers listening who need some last words to take with them.
Well, I'll say what I always say, which is find a time to write that's the same time every day and for the same amount of time every day, and stick to that schedule without any excuses at all.
Mm.
5 days a week. Don't pretend you
work 5 to 7.
And I my advice is the same. There's no,
because you learned from me.
Learned from me. Michael really did. The most important lesson that Michael taught me was discipline, and it took a long time to learn it. And that is the difference between someone who wants to be a writer and someone who's writing.
Hmm.
It's just, you know, chair time.
If you can get into the habit, you'll find it becomes a very dominant, powerful habit that then you will feel when you are not writing. You will feel physically ill at ease, and that you will need to write to sort of assuage that feeling.
Yes.
And then you don't ever have to worry about the muse.
No.
Because it's there in your chair waiting for you, or in my case, in bed at 5 o'clock in the morning.
Well, I do appreciate having both of you. It's been fun.
It's been fun for us.
Yes, thanks,
Barbara.
Thank
you so much.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. That was Ayelet Waldman, author of The Big Nap, and Michael Chabon, author of The Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay. Both wonderful books. And if you haven't already, please take a look. I'm going to take a real short break and come right back for a few more minutes. So I hope you stay tuned. We still have, about 14 minutes left. So don't leave me. Not yet. And welcome back to Writers on Writing for a few more minutes. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I usually play that song at the half when we've gone about 27 minutes, and Michael and Ayelet had to be in San Francisco at 6, and we're willing to go longer, but I wanted to let them go so their lives could go a little easier. But I want to read something to you now, something that fits in with what they were talking about planting yourself on the chair and writing every day, most days, 5 days. This piece is from my unpublished book on writing that may be published someday if I ever send it out again, called Write This Moment, and this chapter is called No Snail Likes Flat Beer. In Southern California, slugs and snails are as plentiful as cars on the freeway. Nurseries line shelves with boxes of snail bait. So much so, you'd think the gusty gastropods were the plague. Actually, they are. My poor polka dot plant hangs shredded all because of a slug. Red ripe strawberries, inedible, because they were a snail's idea of a snack. Still, I put off buying the bait. Call me superstitious. I didn't want the word death on any product in my house. Then I heard snails and slugs liked beer, so I popped open a can of Budweiser left over from a party. Someone brought it, and Brian, a Coors man, won't drink it even if there's nothing else in the house. I placed lids around our teensy garden, setting them especially close to the strawberries and tomatoes, and filled them with beer. At least the slimy creatures could go on to the next level, feeling no pain. The next morning I went outside just as a slug was pulling itself from a lid onto the dirt. One measly slug had drowned. You need deeper bowls, a friend told me, so they can't crawl back out. Well, everyday dishes do, I said, or should I use good china? After my son went to bed, I went outside, and holding the flashlight between my chin and neck, I peered through clumps of leaves and searched the dirt beneath plants. When I found a gastropod, I sprinkled salt on it, but I just could not take watching it shrivel up. Torturer! So I took to picking them up, telling them I was sorry, and tossing them to the street. That was no good either. The crunch of their shell on the pavement got to me. I reverted to beer. Whenever Brian had a cold one, I'd swipe the bottle when there was an inch or so left and pour it into a small plastic container. I still didn't catch any snails. It occurred to me, perhaps, like most humans, no snail likes flat beer. And who wants to go and buy a six-pack for a pack of unappreciative gastropods? I finally broke down and went to the nursery for snail and slug bait. After watching the pests decimate flowers and vegetable seedlings, I had to make a choice. The plant's life or the snail's. I still feel pangs of guilt. There is so much to feel guilty over. Not writing is right up there at the top of my list. If you're still deliberating whether you're a writer, look at your guilt quotient. Do you feel bad when you don't write? Do you ride yourself endlessly about how you should write more? And when you do write, do you feel the burden lift? Do you breathe a sigh of relief and feel good for the rest of the day? Joanne Mapson, author of 5 novels and a short story collection, is known for being dramatic and for reducing life to its essence, including guilt. I don't feel guilty when I don't write, she said. I just feel as if someone cut off my hands, incomplete, inarticulate, and mopey. Whether published or not, if you feel you've wasted your day if you haven't written one paragraph, this is a good indication you're a writer. Snails can tell the difference between fresh and flat beer, just as writers know the difference between meaningful work and just work. It's natural to feel guilty if you don't do what you say you're going to do. It's called being accountable. Sometimes it takes putting yourself on a schedule, getting your biological clock accustomed to writing at a certain time. Everything in the universe is on a schedule. Those snails know that late at night, when it's dark and damp out, it's time for them to mosey about the garden. Nature's schedule is solid. There's a proper place and time for everything. If you don't have a best time to write, try different times of day. Try different locations, too. In the yard, the cafe, the bookstore, the park, the mall, at a Denny's or Coco's or another restaurant, by a freeway, a turnpike exit that has interesting people watching. National Book Award winner Gerald Stern told my radio audience that he writes first thing in the morning at a McDonald's near his Lambertville, New Jersey home. He buys a cup of discounted senior citizens coffee and allows the words to leak from his pen. Neil Schusterman takes his laptop to a nearby Borders. For 6 months of the year, Alex Kate Schulman retreats to Maine, where she lives a rustic existence and says she gets her best work done. The main thing is to stop feeling guilty. Correct the balance. When you're writing the right amount for you, guilt will cease to be your close but despised friend. There you have it. Just do it 5 days a week, same time, 15 minutes a day, actually. You can get something done. That doesn't sound like much, but 15 minutes a day can give you a page a day, can give you 365 pages at the end of a year, and there's a book, there's a draft. All right, the show's done for today. It's been fun. I'm happy to have you and out there listening. And if you have any comments or questions or would like to know about future guests and events in the area, visit my website at writersonwriting.com, and there you can sign up to be on the mailing list and get a weekly email that tells you who's going to be on. You have been listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Thank you for listening, and please stay safe.